Gideo Harding Newman, Reel 4. I'd just like to ask you a couple of more things about the amalgamation of the 3rd and 5th Armoured Car Companies into the 6th Battalion. I'm interested particularly in this problem of amalgamating two companies, because I imagine that one of the things that must have been felt by both companies was a certain loss of autonomy as a result of being compressed into a larger unit.
Yes, that's very true. Both companies did feel they'd been very independent, as an armoured car company would be. The third had, I think, arrived in Egypt from Mesopotamia or some beginning, the end of the First War, and the fifth had come in much later from Shanghai. And they'd both been very individual units, their own barracks, their own COs, and there was a considerable rivalry, naturally, I think, between the two in every walk, really, of sports, technical, and military generally. And although I think all the officers and everyone got on very well together, there was still the feeling of the rivalry when they just became A and C companies of the 6th Battalion. You can't just iron out that rivalry and that feeling of competition, if you like, which still existed, although they then had become two companies of the same major unit, battalion. There was still that very much great rivalry and barter and bickering between all ranks, right from the officer down to the other ranks. There was no doubt. They worked together all right, but there was a very considerable rivalry, and it wasn't an easy unit to coordinate and make into a one cohesive unit, I think.
Did the selection of the officer to command the battalion help or hinder the process of unification, as it were?
No, I would say that it didn't help it. I think it was, from the point of view of starting a new battalion of that type with two units being combined, it was, I would say, an unlucky choice. He was eccentric, and I don't think he was the right man. Looking back on it, I don't think probably one all we thought at the time he was the right man for the job. You could, I'm sure, have from amongst the various officers of the regiment found someone who would have been more considerate and more understanding of the feeling and combined to make a better unit. He was a very brilliant officer. Perhaps that was part of his failing. He hadn't got the understanding and the common sense of many, but he was a brilliant officer. But I say rather than eccentric. And I don't think helped to mould that unit into a really cohesive battalion.
Can you think of any particular problems which relate to his personality, as opposed to the usual processes you might expect?
Well, he did such odd things, as I was saying before. He would take his staff car, with or without a driver, quite often without, just drive out into the desert, and then get it stuck or abandon it and walk back. He had an artistic temperament to a certain extent. He used to do sketching, and one suspects he would go out and, you know, start to get up a hill and start to sketch or to visualize something. It might even be a military matter, and then forget he hadn't walked out there, forget he cowled together and walked back. Not very far, no danger. But he was an eccentric type of person, and I don't think appreciated perhaps the material he had under him at the time.
Who was he?
Colonel Costin Nairn. I don't know how he's reported on, you might say, in the big history books.
But that's N-E-A-N, is it? Nairn?
C-O-S-T-I-N-N-I-A-N, Costin Nairn. Uh-huh. I rather think he passed in and out of the staff college first, in both cases. Mm. A brilliant person, but not necessarily the right person for that particular unit at the time.
Mm. We talked about the re-equipping of the companies, and now the battalion as it became, with the Mark Twain medium vicars, but not long after you receive your first deliveries of Carden Lloyds as well, that very popular machine.
Yes, it was I imagine it was the same as so many of the new equipment. It was sent out to Egypt to see its ability. It was a small, light, in some certainty comparatively fast vehicle, which could be used for reconnaissance, and it had a machine gun. It was very easily hidden, being a low silhouette. But in Egypt, the most appalling vehicle to have to use under almost any circumstances.
Why?
It was the most uncomfortable vehicle. You had the engine in between the driver and the other passenger, which got incredibly hot. I think it was a Ford engine, and I suspect that one of their first works in an armoured vehicle. And it had very narrow tracks and a short wheelbase. So even on the best of gains, it bucketed about like a Bronco and threw one back and forth, back and forth. And being only about 3 foot off the ground, you've got all the sand and the dirt and the dust thrown up in your face and all over the vehicle and you. So it was a dirty vehicle from that point of view. And, of course, would in any, if you weren't very careful and didn't have an extremely good driver, it was about the easiest vehicle to get bogged and to throw a track. And once it had thrown a track, it was the most devilish job to try and get the track on again. The jacking problem in soft sand, and it was nearly always at an angle on a slope or a hill when the track was thrown off. Then you had to break the track, which would be so taut that it was not easy to handle. It was a very, very difficult vehicle.
It sounds like an intrinsically unsuitable machine for those conditions.
I would say it probably was, but it was one of the few light mechanical machines you had, and obviously with an army in Egypt you have to send it out there and have it tried. Mm. I don't think any of the technical boffins who produced it have probably ever been in Egypt or seen it and understood the type of terrain or anything we were working on there. And I would say perhaps until much later on, when you did get a branch of the experimental establishment coming up out in Egypt, that people in England understood what was required and what the problems were for mechanical vehicles out there. The vehicle which had been adopted for the army in England and normal European type of ground was then sent out and see what it was like in Egypt. There was nothing designed specifically for Egypt until much later on, when you started to get people interested in designing machines which were capable. They had better air filters, you had these special tires with a very wide tread produced by Dunlop. Dunlop sent people out there and helped to produce equipment which was suitable for the specific problems of Egypt.
From the point of view of the function of light tank components of RTC forces, namely that they should be the sort of highly mobile reconnaissance element of the tank forces, I'd be interested to hear how, in fact, Carden Lloyd did compare with the Vickers medium from the point of view of mobility.
On fair going, good going, it was faster, but due to its short wheelbase, it really wasn't sufficiently fast compared to the medium tank to carry out the true reconnaissance role. It could never get really far ahead of the medium tank, which would just plod along over any ground at a comparatively small speed, but with the Carden Lloyd bucketing about and jumping about, you couldn't drive it at the speed which it was capable of going, because you just, everyone became just completely worn out. I mean, they just couldn't take the physical punishment that he gave them. And therefore, as a reconnaissance vehicle of the medium tank, it was limited. Mm. I would say very definitely limited.
To change the subject now, you've explained that the time you joined the Armoured Car Company, it was already in the process of handing over its cars to the 12th Lancers. Were you able to get any insight into the process of mechanizing the 12th Lancers, that is to say, about their retraining and their attitudes to mechanization?
No, not really, because I never actually did any of the work with the 12th Lancers. In other words, I never met them on military ground during the conversion. It was done by another officer who had wide experience of armoured cars and who did the whole thing, and he used to spend all his time over there. What I do know is that having been one of the two regiments to accept mechanisation under the then Colonel Charrington, that they accepted it completely and utterly, and they really did their damnedest to become a really efficient armoured car regiment. In other words, they accepted the fact that it was something they'd got to do. I think they probably took it as a great compliment. In fact, I would say that the CO was sufficiently far-sighted to see that he might, by being mechanized early, forestall being abandoned or being disbanded into, you know, as a cavalry regiment and become just another RTR regiment or something like that. In other words, he foresaw that if he accepting mechanization early on, then he was going to continue as the 12th Lancers, but on the mechanized role. Yeah. And no doubt he was a great leader and a great man, and he kept his unit absolutely behind him and all for the mechanization. Now, having said that, I wouldn't say that there weren't a lot of them who didn't dislike the change, because it restricted their horses. I mean, there were no more any charges or a limited number of charges and that sort of thing. And the men they got obviously the new recruits started to be more mechanically minded than horse minded. So it was a very, very considerable effect. And to those who had been brought up with a horse, and after all, anyone who went into the cavalry had been brought up with a horse probably for several generations of their families, it was a tremendous blow to suddenly lose their horses and become part of a mechanized force of which there was a very new element and something they'd never known before. Mm. But from the 12th Lancers point of view, they accepted it and they put everything into it, become extremely efficient, which I think they did. And
right.
Right.
Concentrating on the experimental work now, first of all, could you just explain, as in fact you have just done, why it was that so many vehicles came through your hands for testing in Egypt?
Well, I would put it down to the fact that when the new Brigadier General of Staff came out, Brigadier Lindsay, who was in my regiment tanks, and obviously was a forward-looking officer, particularly on the mechanization point of view, and assuming that those in authority were convinced that a future war was going to be fought in the Middle East or some part of it, it was appreciated, particularly by General Lindsay, that we should want to try vehicles coming into the army in Egypt to see whether they were suitable or not. And I think, again, it was appreciated that a lot of the vehicles and their equipment, such as towers, which were suitable in England and European countries, particularly the type of tower then known as the track type, which had a big tread and grip, to see whether it was suitable. And of course one found, in fact, that what was suitable for the European theatre in the tower side was not suitable for Egypt. So there was that feeling that anything new coming along in the type of vehicle and equipment should be tried out in Egypt. Now, the only people who could do that, who had the mechanical knowledge and background, were ourselves and, to a limited extent, the RASC. And obviously they came into it to a certain extent. Most of the experimental work we did was really, until the light tank came along, was done on B vehicles and B vehicle equipment, such as air filters, tires, and that sort of thing, because the difficulty all the time with any vehicle in the desert was its ability to cross soft sand or broken surface of sand. Once you broke the crust of the desert, it became soft. And then you had problems with your getting the vehicle over that ground. And most of the experimental work we did in those days was on adapting the vehicle we had, in some cases new vehicles, but a lot of cases on the load carrier, the vehicle we had, adopting and trying out new types of tires to see whether we could improve their mobility.
Before we deal with particular vehicles that came through your hands, was the testing carried out on a pretty scientific basis? That is to say, was there a prescribed form for testing and evaluation, or did you, on the other hand, create your own testing programs?
I would say there was very little prescribed form. It hadn't reached the stage of the experimental establishment in England sending us out any forms. One had certain guides, but most of it was done by ourselves, and I suspect, in fact, that probably some of the reports we sent back might not have covered all the points they wanted covered, purely because we hadn't had the specific questions that perhaps they wanted in England. On the other hand, I think there's no doubt that from a common sense point of view, we knew what the problems were of getting from A to B, of carrying loads, of supporting, say, tanks or something, and therefore we could try the vehicle and equipment over the sort of terrain and circumstances which we foresaw being used in any war. Of course, at the same time we did these experimental vehicle of equipment, we were testing our own ability to find our way around the desert.
Yes.
It wasn't purely all the experimental trips linked with vehicles were also doing a certain amount towards the navigation or guidance between on the desert, which was difficult.
Did you design a sort of common format for the testing of the various vehicles that came through your hands, or did you tend to look at the individual vehicle and think up tests which seemed to be most appropriate to it?
Now, I would say we took what we were given and we said, right, we've got to test these over the type of ground we foresee being used by a force. In other words, in those days it was the Western Desert and limited to the 200 to 300 miles west of Cairo, that in general terms, and that's where we saw it being used. We didn't do the coastal work, coastal strip, quite as much perhaps we might have done. And therefore we took the vehicles, irrespective of what they were, and tried to use them over this type of ground, and we were comparing their value all the time, one against the other.
From what points of view?
From the point of view of getting from A to B and arriving at the far end as a whole vehicle and a whole crew, so to speak. And, of course, getting the load to support those lighter vehicles, or the lighter V vehicles, of carrying the load to supply them with food, water and petrol.
Now, can we be a little bit more concrete now? And talk about the particular vehicles that came through your hands, the tests you put them through, and the results of those tests.
Well, we had, during the period I can remember now, the Austin 7 in various guises, but basically the military one produced in Egypt, produced in England and sent out to Egypt for test. We had a Jarrett, we had the Riley 9, I think those are most of the passenger type of vehicles.
They had a sort of jeep type application, did they?
Yes, they were. You would be used for company commanders, battalion commanders, staff officers, headquarters staffs, and in the case of other arms, well, the RESC for convoy control and that sort of thing. But they were personnel vehicles rather than load carriers. At the same time, backing up the vehicle, we had load carriers, we had the, mostly in our case, the 30 hundredweight Crosslers, We did have some 30 hundredweight Morrises, but we didn't have any of the bigger three-tonners until much later. It was mostly based on their vehicles, and we then had to try the B vehicle for its capability of going cross-country, its fuel consumption, its water consumption, and its the possibility of how long it would last, and its mobility generally.
Well, taking the staff car type vehicles first, how did the various ones you had to test fare in the conditions under which you tested
them? Well, of course, the one we all used most, but it had its limited capacity, with the Austin 7, because it's so light. And if it did get stuck, it's fairly easy to push it out. But of course, it only carried two people and very limited luggage. The Jarrett, I think we wrote off fairly early and quickly, and I can't ever remember any number of Jarretts coming out there.
Why did you write it off?
Because it hadn't got the power or the torque to negotiate the sand. It was underpowered, and in various ways it was incapable of doing what we wanted of it. In other words, getting across country in any reasonable form at the speed and endurance we wanted. So that, I would say, was discarded fairly early on. The Riley 9 was accepted. It was too heavily bodied in many respects, but it was an efficient mechanical vehicle, and could be got across most types of country, carrying four staff officers, say, or four officers and that sort of thing. And it was a good vehicle. Of course, it was ideal on the tracks and roads, not so good and soft going, but pretty capable on the whole, and accepted in quite a large instance.
As regards the Austins and the Rileys, as a result of your tests, were they modified in any way on your recommendation, to make them more suitable for those conditions?
I don't think there was a great deal you could do. Certainly, yes, the Austin was certainly adapted quite a lot, probably by our own workshops rather more than by England. In other words, vehicles sent out to England would be the vehicle off the production line in England, and then adapt it when it came out there with either bigger tires or a water condenser and certain other equipment which was particular to the desert. In the case of the Riley 9, that would have what we call sand track, which were canvas with bamboo slats in them, to help get them out. The bigger vehicles had those and sand channels. So I would say most vehicles were not adapted in England in any way. They were sent out to us. We knew what improved their performance and capabilities in Egypt. When I say we, that was mostly what we had suggested in the Ordnance Workshop had worked out there. There's a very close liaison between us. And they accepted to a large extent what we, the user, told them. We therefore got what we wanted done, probably more easily than you did in England.
Facilities on the spot for modifications were fairly good, were they?
Were fairly good. We had our own idea, and we could probably do what we call a mock-up of it. And then, I say, I had a very close liaison with the workshops there, and I could go down and discuss it with them. And in many cases, they would accept it, but we always had this problem, which I discussed, I know, with you before, about one particular instance of the condenser, which we had used in civilian and military work on our own, of a very simple rubber pipe from the top of the radiator, the radiator cap, down to a 2-gallon can. But the army couldn't accept that because it didn't look nice, so they put a copper braided pipe onto a can, bolted to the radiator side. And the thing was so inflexible that the cross-country distortions, the pipes used to break, and therefore the thing was no longer any use because it sucked air instead of sucking the water back. But that was an instance close liaison, but not accepting the slightly untidy equipment which was effective, but making it more presentable on a parade ground look.
That's interesting. What about the larger vehicles? How did they prove themselves or fail to prove themselves in the tests you put them through?
The Crossley did very well on the whole, depending. The bigger we got in the way of tyre, particularly on the back, and the smoother, the better the performance. The problem was, as I was saying, that you got the track-type vehicle tyre sent out with them in many cases, which were entirely unsuitable to the desert, because it broke the crust. And then once you break the crust, you get soft sand and bogging. And if one had a smooth, flat-type tyre, and they produced that for the armoured cars, what they call the sand tyre, which had a, it spread out as it came to the tread, and that gave it a bigger area on the sand and a completely smooth tread. And that was far more acceptable and didn't break the surface in the same way. So you got a great, far greater mobility and a far less liability to stick.
Was the sand tyre the same? Same thing as the balloon tyre?
Not the low-pressure tyre, that came later. The sand tyre was adapted specifically for the armoured car, and probably the balloon tyre wouldn't have accepted the weight of the armoured car.
How did the balloon tyre come to be developed and introduced?
By, I would say, this is, you know, casting one mind back and thinking about, on the, far more on the civilian side, by Dunlop's than on the military side originally. But I may be wrong there. Mm. Dunlop certainly sent, when we were testing tyre, they sent representative out, and we had them out there, and they were testing tyre temperatures and all sorts of technical detail which we didn't know about and weren't interested about, really. But I would say the balloon tyre was a development equally due to the civilian side as to the military. Mm. But the sand tyre was prior to that, and that was giving a wider tread to the tyre than would be normal. As one knows, the normal profile of a tyre comes in and you get a narrower tread to the wall, but in the sand tyre, from the wall it spread out and gave you a much wider tread, a much wider area on the ground, which meant a less pressure per square inch. Mm. And therefore less likely to break the crust of the sand and give you a better mobility.
Was the sand tyre a direct consequence of the sort of testing that you were doing?
I would say so, yes, and the 12th Lancer, because obviously they came into this, once they got all their armoured cars, they came into the testing to a rather more limited degree than we did initially, and then they obviously continued it with the car particularly. And of course they originally, when they had twin rear tyres, twin rear wheels on the armoured car, that was the initial one, then they'd use a thick bamboo pole which they put in between the two back wheels to give them a wider surface. And the wheel, or the two tyres, would grip on this bamboo and start to pull them out. The bamboo would stick in the sand and the wheel, would, or the twin wheel, would really climb up the pole and get them out of the sand. That was the first trade, and then you got on to the sand tyre, which of course became the universal tyre for the armoured cars.
You've commented on your evaluation of the Crossley. Now, what about the other of the larger vehicles? How did they turn out?
We were stuck with our little four Crossleys. There wasn't a lot to choose between them. I think perhaps one got used to the vehicle you knew and therefore accepted it. Morris's, I think, did quite well. On the whole, I don't think we ever got any Leyland. They didn't produce any small. They then came on later to the bigger, the three-tonners, which, of course, again came out with the track-type tyre and were very heavy and slow and tended to break through everything with their load and the type of tyres they used. But on the other hand, one started to have to use them because you couldn't carry the load required on the 30 hundredweight. It meant too many vehicles, therefore they said we must have the bigger vehicle, fewer of them. Mm. And that obviously gave problems. Mm.
Are there any other aspects other than the ones we've talked about so far as regards the development of wheeled vehicles for use in Egyptian conditions? Are there any other aspects that were advanced directly as a result of your activities? I mean, I'm thinking of things like tires, mobility, fuel, heating, mechanical developments?
Air filters, obviously, one paid a lot of attention to, because you could ruin an engine literally within a few hundred miles with an inefficient air filter, and therefore that was one of the major aspects one looked at and tested. And I think the oil bath, air filter, they were termed, which meant that you had